We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at the charter school movement. We will be talking to three different guests, each with a different perspective on the issue. Our topic is particularly timely, as currently the Obama administration is promoting the development of more charter schools by linking them with the granting of federal funds. In June 2009, Education Secretary Arne Duncan explicitly stated that states that do not have public charter laws or who put artificial caps on the growth of charter schools will jeopardize their applications under the Race to the Top Fund. Since then, state after state has passed legislation supporting such schools. Illinois, for example, has doubled the number of charter schools it allows. Here to give us some background about the charter school movement is our first guest, Chris Lubianski, Associate Professor of Education Policy, Organization, and Leadership at the University of Illinois. Welcome to our program, Chris. Can we start with your telling us about your involvement with the issue of charter schools?
Oh, yeah, I've been researching charter schools for over 10 years now, particularly interested in how they can be engines of innovation and spur on new developments in classroom practice. But I've also looked at their achievement and quite interested in their governance and how they offer new forms of access for different students.
Well, can you define for us first what a charter school is and how it differs from a typical public or private school?
Yeah, that's actually a very important question because there's a lot of misunderstandings about what charter schools are. Many people seem to associate them with private schools. Charter schools are technically public schools. They're publicly funded. They're tuition-free. But the difference from other public schools is that they're typically not run by a local elected school board or a district. So to kind of put it in a nutshell, charter schools are publicly funded, but independently or privately managed. They could be managed by a nonprofit group that sought a charter to run a school, or in many cases, they're run by for-profit groups, companies that are managing chains of charter schools. Uh-huh. The idea is to bring some of that the incentives that you see in the private sector to try and bring that into the public sector.
Could you tell us a little bit about their history in this country?
Yeah, sure. Charter schools, actually, the idea was formed in the 1970s by a former secondary school principal from Michigan. He was working at one of the regional education labs out in the Northeast, and he came up with this idea of offering groups of teachers a charter or a contract to perform a particular function for a limited amount of time. And he pointed to the old idea of the Hudson's Bay Company, for example, where the British monarch would contract with a corporation like that to fill a particular duty for a while, and then they could reap the profits from that. And he liked that idea of giving groups of teachers an opportunity to try something new, kind of protected from a lot of the district or shielded from some of the district regulations that might kind of inhibit those ideas from forming. It would give them an opportunity over, say, 5 years to experiment with a new educational approach, for example. And he saw that as a way of giving teachers opportunities to develop new classroom practices and really pronounced put more of an emphasis on teacher professionalism.
How did it then go?
Well, that idea actually was embraced by Albert Shanker, who was the president of one of the teachers unions, the AFT, American Federation of Teachers. And he really lauded that idea. Again, he saw this as a way of giving teachers an opportunity to exercise more of their professional judgment and groups of teachers to advance a particular idea within education. And that idea was also embraced by some reformers in Minnesota, some progressive reformers, particularly those who worked with at-risk populations, students that were in danger of dropping out, for example. And they were quite frustrated with the district model of having districts try and serving all types of students. So they saw this as an opportunity to set up smaller schools that would focus on specific populations. This happened in the early 90s, and at about the same time, though, some more conservative in the sense of fans of free markets also saw this idea as a wonderful way to inject kind of the free market model into public education. They saw kind of district monopolies really inhibiting student growth, and so they saw this way of kind of breaking up the teachers' unions. So it's kind of ironic that at one point you had Albert Shanker, the teachers' unions, advancing this idea, but almost immediately people saw this idea as a way to undercut the teachers' unions. And not long after that, Al Shanker really turned his back on charter schools and decided that they weren't a useful idea. So there's always this politics around it about how they've been used to counter different forces within education or advance particular ideologies. But ultimately, right now, there are different things in different states. There are state-level creations, so states set up the regulations and the guidelines for what charter schools can look like. And so they're quite diverse in the models that they reflect.
Well, I know that the Race to the Top Awards, the federal grant program under Obama, goes to states that meet federal requirements in the area of reforming things like standards, technology, teacher evaluation practices, work with failing schools, that it's requiring states to raise, who want to qualify for the awards, to raise their caps on charter schools. So would you say this reflects the current status of charter schools in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. This goes back to the Clinton era. When Clinton was president, his administration forwarded hundreds of millions of dollars for charter school startups to promote the idea. George W. Bush, same thing. His No Child Left Behind Act used charter schools as a model that was supposed to improve failing public schools. And now Obama, you're right, the Obama administration, and Arne Duncan in particular, is quite a fan of charter schools and is requiring states to get rid of any kind of restrictions on their growth in order to qualify for that funding. So it's been a bipartisan support, at least in Washington, D.C., bipartisan support for charter schools over the last decade or so. And it's also a very popular model. You know, in the media, you're probably familiar with the Waiting for Superman movie, for example, which holds out charter schools as kind of this panacea or the savior for public education. And so that's another popular representation of the schools.
Right, but then you have Diane Ravitch as a very sharp criticism of the movie and the movement.
That's right, yeah. And she was a former supporter of charter schools and choice. And then I think looking at some of the research findings on the record for these schools, she's really changed her tune on charters, school choice, and also things like standardized testing, which are, you know, are part and parcel of that movement.
You talked about the groups you see as most supportive. What groups do you see as least supportive? Where's the opposition, if there is any, coming from?
There are some parent groups that are quite upset with how charter schools are being run and managed. And there's concern among some researchers about the results we're seeing from charter schools. But probably the group most associated with opposition to charter schools right now is the teachers' unions. And that's might be somewhat unfair because they would often say that they're supporters of reform. They going back to the beginning of the movement, they supported the idea of giving teachers more autonomy. But as corporations and for-profit groups have moved in to the charter school sector, I think they feel like that possibility has been pushed aside somewhat. So even though in some cases charter schools have been started by some teachers' unions in a few instances, by and large they're associated with the opposition towards charter schools.
I just was looking at the debate between Carolyn Huxley at Stanford and Margaret Raymond of the Hoover Institute. Have I got the names right?
Yes, that's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about their differing results?
Well, just a little bit of background there. Carolyn Huxley is an economist who has been interested in school choice programs, so not just charter schools, but also other forms of cross-boundary choices. She tends to look at cases where she finds positive results for that, even when other researchers don't. She tends to find positive results. And so she's associated with the conservative Hoover Institute out at Stanford University now. Also at Stanford is Margaret Raymond, who, interestingly enough, also was somewhat associated with the pro-charter school movement. And she did a large study of 16 states with charter with a funded by some pro-charter school organizations, such as the Walton Family Foundation, which, you know, is associated with Walmart, for example. And to many people's surprise, she found after, when you look at the charter school growth, the academic growth of students in charter schools in those 16 states, the most charter schools, compared to demographically comparable public schools, charter schools weren't doing so well. As a matter of fact, only about 17% of the charter schools were outperforming, statistically significantly outperforming the matched public school students. And about 50% of the cases, the charter school students were statistically indistinguishable from the matched group. And in about a third of the cases, they were underperforming. So that was quite a shock to a lot of people because, you know, less than one in five charter schools seems to be succeeding academically. And there had been a lot of hope and expectations for this movement. And a third of them were demonstrably failing. So she published that study, and as has been the pattern, Carolyn Hoxsey quickly released some findings from her own study that would seem to counter that. So she looked at charter schools in New York City, and in a rather rigorous study, she found that charter schools there were actually adding value to, that is, they're boosting the achievement of students in charter schools quite significantly. So those students were getting an education that's comparable to many of the more affluent suburban students in that area. So they came up with different findings, but I should point out they looked at very different forms of evidence. Raymond's study was of 16 states, more of a national sample, whereas Hoxsey's study was of New York City. So you have to ask yourself, is there anything particularly unique about charter schools in New York City or the context there that would lead to those results? And are those reflective of the country at large?
Well, what number of children are being educated in charter schools?
It's pretty significant now. I mean, remember, this movement started in the early 90s. So in 1991, I think there was one charter school. And now we have about 1.7 million kids in charter schools, and they've really grown quite significantly. We have about, I think it's 5,500 charter schools now. States have been adding them, not just because the Obama administration is requiring them to do that, but many states have already had rather liberal laws towards charter school expansion. So in many cases, they've been proliferating quite quickly.
Are there any international parallels?
Oh yeah, there are. I mean, there's many other countries where they have much more of an entrenched choice system than in the U.S. We very much have a district system where people go to their local public schools in the U.S. And if you don't go to your local public school, that's more the exception. In other countries, for example, I've just been doing some research in New Zealand, it's pretty much expected that you're going to shop around for schools and find a school that best fits your child. Now, that choice is exercised in different ways. There's things like social class and race that really seem to shape how people make that choice. But there's other countries that have gone much further. But what's, I think, interesting about charter schools in the U.S. is that they are usually newer schools that just started up, as opposed to other countries like, as I mentioned, in New Zealand, for example, or Australia, where these are established schools that were then opened up to accept students based on choice. In the U.S., these are typically new schools that are started by somebody who has an idea about how to run a school. These might be groups of teachers or educators, or they might be somebody else that has no background in education. But the whole idea here was to open up the market, to allow new forms of providers to come in and offer education. So that's kind of unique. There's been efforts in the U.K., in England and Wales, to try and replicate that more, like we're doing in the U.S.
Now, are there any accountability requirements for charter schools?
Yeah, but there's different forms of accountability requirements. So the basic idea with charter schools is that district schools, public schools run by districts, are based on top-down mandates. You know, you have officials that tell schools what they need to do, and then those schools have to meet particular regulations and restrictions. And too often, when those schools are failing, nothing substantial things that happened to those schools. Charter schools, on the other hand, the whole idea here was to give those schools a lot of autonomy, to give them a lot of freedom to try new things. So they're often free of much of the school code. They don't have, for example, as many reporting requirements. Many of them don't have the traditional union collective bargaining things, requirements. So that gives them more freedom in terms of pay scales or who to hire and that type of thing.
But then their students don't have to make adequate yearly progress or meet any of those goals?
Well, no, they're still subject to some of those regulations. But what I want to emphasize here is that there's a new form of accountability brought in here. So as opposed to your traditional public school that may be failing, there doesn't seem to be a lot happening to that school to force it to improve. At least this is the argument of charter school advocates. But there's a new form of accountability with charter schools, and that's market accountability. Parents are now seen as customers. And if that school is failing, they're expected to then pull their kids out of that school and go somewhere else. Whether or not that's actually worked is a different question, but that's the thinking on paper, at least.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. You've really given us a good background and understanding of the movement. And again, thanks for being a guest on the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Examining Education. We've been listening to Chris Lubienski of the University of Illinois give us some background about the charter school movement. Our next guest will be Andrew Broy, president of the Illinois Network of Charter Schools. This is Examining Education. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. We're talking about charter schools and the question of whether they can and should play a key element in educational reform. I want to welcome Andrew Broy to our program. Andrew is president of the Illinois Network of Charter Schools. Let's start with you telling us about your involvement with the charter school movement and about the Illinois Network of Charter Schools.
Sure. Thanks for having me today. I'm happy to give you a little background. I began my career in the early 1990s as a teacher. I taught high school English for a number of years and have since migrated to work in the charter school sector. I currently work for the Illinois Network of Charter Schools. We're a statewide membership and support organization working with 116 charter schools in Illinois that collectively serve 52,000 students this current year. And we are designed to really help improve the quality of charter schools in the state, expand the number so parents have more access to schools, and then advocate for what we think is good public education policy, both at the city level in Chicago, the regional level in Rockford, Peoria, other cities, and then at the state level in Springfield.
Today, the number of charter schools is growing, and they currently educate 3% of our 50 million public school students. How would you describe the promise of charter schools in regards to educational reform? In other words, arguments in their favor.
Sure. I think some of the strongest arguments in support of the charter model are based really on what makes a charter school a charter school. To be clear, charter schools are public schools, and that means they take all students who apply. If there are too many applicants for the number of seats available, they must hold a blind lottery in which every student has an equal chance of attending. They can't charge tuition. They have to be secular. And so in most respects, they're public like any other school. The key difference, however, is that they're held accountable to what's called a charter contract between the local school board, typically, and the school itself. And the idea behind these five-year contracts is that the district will give the charter school autonomy and flexibility in key areas like personnel, curriculum, resource allocation, in exchange for a promise from the charter to achieve rigorous achievement goals. And the idea would be that if the charter meets those goals after 5 years, it gets another five-year charter. If it doesn't meet those goals, the charter can be terminated and the school can be closed. So it's designed to really exchange flexibility on the one hand for accountability on the other, and then create better schools.
What do you find are the main arguments against charter schools?
Yeah, they come in two varieties. So one common argument against charter schools is that they drain money from the regular public school system, and that's because when a charter school locates in a given school district, say in Chicago, and 500 students choose to go to that school, the money that would have gone to the regular public school to educate those students now goes to the charter school. We at the Illinois Network think that's appropriate because the school that lost the students is no longer incurring the cost to educate them. What some of the schools would say, however, and this is a valid point, I think, is that when they lose two or three students, their fixed costs don't go down, even though the revenue does. And so what we're trying to work on is making sure the impact on traditional public schools is minimized as we grow the number of charters in the state. And in Chicago, for context, fully 12% of public school students, or 50,000 students, are now enrolled in charter schools.
You were talking about the accountability of charter schools before, and I wondered what you thought of Margaret Raymond of the Hoover Institute studies of charter schools, where she says only 17% perform better, 46% perform the same, and 37% perform below public schools. Do they get closed after 5 years?
Yeah, this is actually the Hoover Institute did the Credo study a couple of years ago that examined national charter data. And I think that what she found, which is true, is that charter performance across the country is quite uneven, which is to say there's some very good charter schools, some mediocre charter schools, and some not-so-good charter schools. What I found particularly interesting about the Credo study, though, is that if you look at state-by-state analysis, there were four jurisdictions out of the 17 studied that had statistically significant outperformance, meaning greater performance than comparable students in regular public schools. And Chicago, I'm happy to say, was in that category. But it is fair to say that we as a sector have not done a good enough job in closing underperforming charter schools, and we have a lot more work to do to make sure that charter schools live up to the promise of the model, which again is highly performing, accountable schools that can drive student achievement forward.
What about some of the criticisms that charter schools skim off the cream?
Yeah, that's something that we've heard for really the whole 20 years of the charter school movement, that when these were established in the early 90s in Minnesota, which is the first state to pass a charter law, that the schools would wind up attracting the most highly performing students, more affluent students, and that would have a negative impact on the traditional public schools. What we've seen happen over the past 20 years, however, is that charter schools today are much more likely to enroll students who are both African-American and Latino and or qualify for free and reduced lunch, so we're in poverty. So we've seen actually the opposite effect, where charter schools are attracting students who are more likely to be poor and more likely to be racial minorities. And what's interesting now is in the past 3 years, we've seen some criticisms out of the Civil Rights Project in California, too, that charter schools are now resegregating public schools because most of the schools that we've opened do serve predominantly African-American and Latino students. I think that's a bit of a misses the mark on the critique side because that's merely a function of where charter schools locate. Most charter schools in urban areas in Chicago and New York and D.C. and Atlanta and L.A. are locating in neighborhoods that themselves are already segregating. So it's not much of a surprise that when they enroll students in those neighborhoods, the schools wind up being predominantly one race.
What about the criticism that there aren't enough special ed students or English language learners?
Yeah, I think that that's actually a valid claim for some charter schools around the country. I think that charter schools struggle, like regular public schools do, frankly, to serve students with special education or ELL needs. I would note, however, that there's something important here, and that is that in a lot of places, charter schools' mission is to mainstream students who come in with mild disabilities. Mm-hmm. So they may have an EIP meeting, an IEP meeting early on and decide the best approach for a student with a mild disability is to be mainstreamed in regular school, regular classrooms. And so if that's the case, the student might be getting all the services he or she needs but not showing up as a special ed student anymore. And I would view that in an individual case as a sign of progress, not as a sign of distress.
What about criticism that charter schools are not just stratifying kids by race, but also if they're charter schools just for special ed kids, then they're being segregated and not being mainstreamed?
Yeah, I do worry a bit about those schools. There aren't many charter schools that were set up to serve students with disabilities. There are a couple of them. There are a couple in New York, a couple in Florida. So they're rare. But I, to the folks that criticize them, I always kind of say, on the one hand, you're saying charter schools don't enroll enough students with disabilities, and now you're criticizing schools that set themselves up to try to serve that need that's not being met elsewhere. I'm not sure we can win on this. What we want to do is make sure we have great schools that serve student needs. And there's one point that I like to emphasize that some people miss about charter schools, and that is this. No student anywhere is zoned into a charter school without choice. Unlike regular public schools that typically have attendance zones and the students enroll in those schools as a matter of where they live, in charter schools, students have to choose that model. So it always frustrates me a bit when people say you're sending them to a charter school and they don't want to go, because that's just not true. People choose to go. If they don't want to go to the school, they need not. They can go to a local regular public school, and then the charter school would frankly struggle to stay open. So the fact that we have so much growth in the charter sector, I think, is evidence that parents and communities are choosing these schools in higher and higher numbers.
Another criticism I've heard is that though they were initially created to encourage local innovation and implementations, they're being taken over by franchises and for-profit schools.
Yeah, this is the kind of management company debate that goes on in some charter schools. The data is not all that clear nationally, but in some charter schools, the governing board of the school itself hires what's called a management company to help run the school. And that can vary from doing back office support and payroll work to actually fully managing the school. And it's really hard to paint with a broad brush on this, because there are all sorts of management companies out there, some that are quite good and some that are frankly not so good. And so what we're worried about in the sector is trying to identify the good ones and scale up those models, and then try to identify the bad management companies that may be in it for the wrong reasons, and making sure that they do not get the benefit of running any more schools. And I think in the past 2 to 3 years especially, there's been an increased focus on charter school authorization to make sure that the bodies that actually grant the charters vet the management companies appropriately, so that only ones with strong track records are able to work managing schools that serve students.
Another concern people have voiced is about the openness and transparency of finances.
Yeah, and I think this is, I mean, law is fairly clear on this. Charter schools are funded based on a per pupil allotment from the districts in which they're located, and then they have to spend those dollars at the school level. Almost all states require charter schools to submit audited financials annually. In addition to that, individual authorizers, those that grant the charters, can ask for periodic reports. So, for instance, I know here in Chicago, they require monthly financial data to go from the charter schools to the district officials. They can look at that and make decisions about what's appropriate. But keep in mind, the main idea here is that the charter school will earn funding based on students enrolled and then spend it as it needs to at the school site level and then produce academic outcomes for the kids. The idea is not like in a traditional public school where you'd earn funding based on programs and then that money would drive the resource decisions at the school site. It's about flexibility and autonomy.
Now, you talked about 4 outstanding jurisdictions. Would you point to any states whose oversight provides a particularly good model to follow?
Yes, I think on the positive side, you'd look at states like New York and Michigan. I think Chicago is probably in this category. As states where there's been pretty robust charter school oversight, which has created a strong quality sector. On the downside, just to be very candid, there are states like Ohio, which a number of years ago decided to open up hundreds of charter schools in very short order and have had, I think, a difficult time maintaining quality. So the one thing I like to say when I'm on panels discussing charter schools is that charter schools are neither good nor bad. They're really a school governance model, and they're good to the extent they're held accountable and are run by professionals who want to put students' needs first. But the model can also be corrupted if you have bad leadership, a bad management company, or a different model. So we've got to make sure to focus on not just what type of school we're talking about, but whether it's serving the kids in the way it needs to.
What about other countries? Do you see any other countries as models?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen in the past 2 years, in England especially, an idea of trying to use the charter model and adapt it to what they've been doing there for the past three or four decades. And some people visiting, even we had some London dignitaries come visit our network schools about 6 months ago to see how we're managing to serve students in challenging neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. So we're starting to see this idea flow outward into other countries, because I think it has a lot of appeal. The idea that you're not going to enforce a bureaucratic approach on all the schools, like districts typically do, but rather decide, let the schools be autonomous, let them perform, and if they perform well, let them keep going. If they don't, find another strategy.
Well, one of my guests, Chris Lubianski, said that the marketplace was supposed to be the test for charter school accountability. How well do you see that as working?
Yeah, I actually disagree with that. I think there was an idea 15 years ago the marketplace would decide, but there are two constraints. One, right now, today in Chicago, we've got 15,000 parents on waiting lists trying to get into charter schools, so the market is not keeping up with the demand. But I also think that we have a much more important role to play in oversight of charter schools than just letting parent demand drive how many schools we have. So, for instance, there are a number of schools across the country, charter schools, that are very poor schools in terms of academic outcomes for kids, but the students enjoy the school and the parents keep sending the children to that school. The question I would ask in return is, if we have a poorly performing charter school that does not succeed year after year, yet parents keep sending their children to that school, is that fact sufficient to keep it open? In my judgment, the answer is no. That parent choice is necessary to make sure a charter school succeeds in that you have to enroll students, but it's not sufficient to justify the school staying open.
So can you go over again what accountability requirements you would want it to meet?
Sure. I mean, you would want most of your accountability requirements to be on the academic outcome side, both in terms of absolute achievement for students to make sure they're achieving a bar that is getting close to proficient or above for the grade level, but also, I think equally important, is to show growth year after year in the charter school among the same cohort of students. So, for instance, in many of our urban areas, a charter school will open up and enroll a number of students who are well below grade level. I think in that case, it's very important to make sure as the school progresses year to year, those students narrow the gap between their proficiency and grade level year over year, so you want to see real growth. In addition to those academic outputs, you want to make sure you have some governance and financial accountability in place to make sure the school is spending money appropriately, that it's appropriately accountable, that its governing board has open meetings, it hires vendors appropriately, all the things schools do. If we have that sort of accountability, the chances of having great schools increases dramatically.
What do you see as the future of charter schools?
That's a great question. I've thought a lot about this over the past few years especially. There are cities in this country, New Orleans and D.C., for instance, where more than 45% of the public school students go to charter schools. So we're seeing a system ramp up in places that is showing how well schools can do if the model works. I see the future as being continued growth. I think accelerated growth among the high-performing schools. We're seeing a lot of schools that are successful going from 3 to 4 campuses up to 10 or 15 campuses. We're seeing a lot of interest at the federal level to replicate high-performing charter schools. And we're seeing, this is, I think, one of the core promises of charter schooling, we're seeing some migration of practices between high-performing charters and the regular public school system. I'll give you one example to make that plain. Here in Chicago, we've had a painfully short school day and school year for the better part of the past 20 years. Today in Chicago, students go to school 170 instructional days a year compared to the national average of 180, and they go to school 5 hours and 45 minutes compared to the national average of between 6.5 hours and 7 hours. In the charter schools, we've already closed that gap. So the charter school average is 180 days of instruction and about 7 hours per day. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has made one of his key priorities extending the school day in Chicago. So what you're seeing is what we've been doing in the charter sector for the past decade is now migrating back to the regular public school sector as a way to reform schools by giving students more time in the classroom. And I see more of those sorts of things happening on teacher evaluation, on compensation, on performance evaluation of principals and superintendents as the years go by.
This is Examining Education. Our topic is charter schools. We've just been talking with Andrew Broy, president of the Illinois Network of Charter Schools. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. This is Examining Education. I am your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. We're talking about charter schools and the question of whether they can and should play a key element in educational reform. I want to welcome Gary Muron to our program. Gary is professor of education at Western Michigan University. He has extensive experience evaluating school reforms and education policies. Let's start with you telling us about your involvement with the issue of charter schools.
Sure. I've been doing research on charter schools for the last 15 years. I've been asked by state education agencies to come in and conduct 9 state evaluations of charter school reforms. And I've been asked by the federal government also to do a larger 3-year study on correlates of success in American charter schools. Aside from that, I've been doing a lot of technical assistance for charter schools, helping them to develop accountability plans, operationalize their mission statements so that can be incorporated into the accountability plan, and also helping them to demonstrate success, you know, according to those unique measures that they should have.
Well, we'll be getting on to that accountability in a little bit. Today, the number of charter schools is growing, and they currently educate 3% of our 50 million public school students. How would you describe the promise of charter schools in regard to educational reform? In other words, what were the arguments in their favor?
Right. I'm you know, a lot of people, they look at my research and I see some of the studies that I've done that have been positive in favor of charter schools, and I think I'm an advocate for charter schools, and others look at some of my studies, for example, from Michigan and Ohio, and think that I'm an opponent of charter schools. And I'm really neither. I look at charter schools and I call them as I see them in terms as an evaluator. Now, when it comes to the charter school idea, I'm very much in favor of the idea. I like the idea. It's a solid idea. And if we go back 2 decades, we see that the charter school idea was something that we don't often talk about today. And the reform that we are experiencing today is very different than what was once envisioned. What was envisioned is that we were going to have local new opportunities for local educators and other community members to start their own schools. These are going to be innovative schools. They were not going to be similar to traditional public schools. They would be unique in terms of their pedagogical approaches. And they were also going to be highly accountable and able to demonstrate success.
So what have been your observations?
Well, today we see that most charter schools are, the new charter schools that are being opened are largely those being started by outside groups, not by community groups. Today, 1/3 of the nation's charter schools are operated by for-profit or non-profit private education management organizations. And so rather than having these small community groups or community-based schools, we're getting national franchises of schools. Some of these schools are run across the state. Some are run from halfway across the country. So this notion of locally community-based schools is there's still some of those that exist, but they're increasingly smaller in the overall proportion of the schools.
That's interesting, because I thought we'd talked to Henry Levin at Columbia, and he'd said that the record of for-profit schools in this country hadn't been too successful.
That That's correct. They're successful at starting schools, but when we look at the evidence in terms of their performance, those that are operated by for-profit schools, their performance levels on the whole tend to be not better than those local mom-and-pop charter schools.
And also that they hadn't made any money. He was talking about the Edison schools having lost a lot of money.
Yeah, we see many of the bigger companies not making money as a company, but individuals are profiting. Very big individuals in those companies are doing very well. And there are some companies that are profiting quite well, especially those that are building equity through facilities and so forth. That there is one company that is publicly, only one company today that is publicly traded, and that is K-12 Incorporated. Their stocks went up during the previous calendar year. Their stocks went up 60% in value, even while only 25% of those schools operated by that for-profit company met adequate yearly progress. So this is an example of one company that's profiting quite well.
Well, in terms of meeting adequate yearly progress, I thought that charter schools didn't have to.
Oh, certainly they're like any other public school. They have to they have the same compliance expectations under No Child Left Behind as traditional public schools. The one advantage that charter schools have is often because they have fewer numbers of test takers, especially children with special needs or some other subgroups. They don't often get marked down for because there's not enough test students in those subgroups to be noted for not making adequate yearly progress, where in some districts all the subgroups are making adequate yearly progress except for maybe a subgroup of special ed students. Charter schools often don't have enough students in each of those subgroups that they have to report that data publicly. So in many respects, they sometimes have it easier to make adequate yearly progress with the subgroups.
It sounds as though you maybe share some of Diane Ravitch's criticisms. And for our audience, let me just explain. She's an historian of education and policy analyst. She wrote The Death and Life of the Great American School System. In it, she tells how she formerly supported choice, but she's now opposed to it. And now she spends a lot of her time testifying against choice in charters. So what do you think of her position?
Yeah, I understand it quite well. And I think that, she was initially in favor of charter schools, but I think it was the rhetoric that we heard in the early and mid-90s is very different what we're hearing today. You know, the things that charter schools were supposed to do, you know, we haven't really seen them come to bear. So I can certainly understand her concern today about the way charter schools are being implemented and how they're being used. It's not at all what was anticipated.
Well, what about the research about how well they've actually fulfilled the promise of increasing students' achievement, particularly in impoverished neighborhoods?
Yep, we've looked at every couple years, myself and a couple of my colleagues here at Western Michigan University, we do a synthesis of all the evidence on student achievement in charter schools. Basically, what we do is we look at all the evidence across the country, all the new studies that have come out, and we plot out we create a little graph, and we rate the studies in terms of their impact rating, whether they're positive or negative, and we also rate those studies in terms of the quality of the design. And we find that there's no evidence, conclusive evidence that charter schools are outperforming traditional public schools. What we usually see is that the larger scale studies tend to be more negative, and then the smaller studies that focus on a fewer or, you know, isolated groups of schools tend to be more positive in favor of charter schools. But when we look at the overall evidence, it suggests that there's no difference in the performance of charter schools. If anything, it's charter school students are performing slightly at a slightly lower level compared to their demographically matched peers.
I listened recently to an address by Arne Duncan to a convention of charter school advocates, and he was advising them to try to meet some of the criticisms that they were skimming the best students. And he was urging them to have special schools for EL, for English language learners, et cetera, et cetera. And also he was arguing that he would like to see more accountability. What do you think of his approach?
Well, isn't that a wonderful idea? Highly accountable schools. You would think that after two decades, and I argued this after a single decade, I'd said, because people were still saying, well, the evidence isn't there, but, you know, they need more time. And I'm thinking, wait a second, if these are going to be highly accountable schools, and if after a decade we still don't have a conclusive answer, that is the answer. They're not going to be highly accountable. And if after two decades, Arne Duncan is saying, could you please help to demonstrate accountability? If we still don't have evidence that they can be highly accountable, you know, I'm a little bit more pessimistic. But in reality, that is a real concern of theirs, and his concern also about addressing other criticisms like skimming the best students. This is something that's difficult for charter schools to address, in part because so much of the skimming that takes place is parents self-selecting. It's not so much charter schools selecting the students, although some of them, because they set up particular college prep profiles or they have particular recruiting messages, they may help to select families. But in most cases, families that are self-selecting. A couple national studies last year, one from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, and then here at Western Michigan University, we also did a national study looking at the demographics in charter schools. And both studies concluded that charter schools were accelerating the resegregation of our nation's public schools by race, by class, by ability, and also by language.
How would you counter that?
We did in both studies essentially looked at charter schools and compared them to their local populations of local districts and the demographics of those students in those schools. And what we were seeing is that many people had been concerned about charter schools being used as a vehicle for white flight, with white middle-class families leaving urban areas to go to white schools. And sure enough, that does exist. But both studies also found that black flight was much more prevalent than white flight, where families in diverse schools, say 60% African-American, were leaving to go to schools with 90 to 95% African-American students. So we saw these schools being used in that way. The same with children with special needs. In the nation, there's about 40 to 45 charter schools that specialize in children with special needs. And here we're seeing 60 to 100% of the students had individualized education plans and were classified as disabled. On the whole, however, we saw charter schools with very few children with disabilities, and those that they do serve tend to have very mild disabilities that were very easily and less costly to remediate.
Chris Lubianski talked about how the marketplace was supposed to be the accountability test, and he didn't think it was working too well. What's your own take on that?
Well, there's various forms of accountability. You have performance accountability in terms of their academic performance. You have the market accountability. And the market accountability is very hard to demonstrate. There is demand from families, but in many charter schools, we're also seeing families voting with their feet and leaving, and yet they're being replaced by others. So, but the market accountability mechanism, it's very difficult. Some people have been saying parents, market accountability is sufficient because parents every day are judging the schools, and if they don't like those schools, they'll pull their kids out. Of course, market accountability doesn't work that well in schools because families aren't going to pull their kids out every other week and switch schools. They have to be selective on how often they choose. So in some cases, we have schools that are not performing well, and parents continue to keep their children there. But the thing that's really sad for me about charter schools is that they were supposed to have a different type of accountability. They were going to be mission-driven and not held, academic performance was important, but what was more important was that they would have unique missions that would be operationalized and they would be highly accountable for those unique missions. And that's where I think the charter school ideal has failed the most. And in part, it's because the charter schools haven't demonstrated success. They haven't been proactive and demonstrated success. But it's also because of the re-regulation of charter schools by state and federal agencies. No Child Left Behind is one example of that, forcing charter schools to be held accountable and take the same standardized tests as traditional public schools essentially meant that charter schools had to begin teaching to the same test and adopting similar instructional methods. So they began looking more and more like traditional public schools and felt less and less of the need to demonstrate success according to a unique mission because policymakers were more interested in their test results rather than their annual report about their unique goals and objectives.
Well, this is very interesting. You're getting it now into the question of assessment, but how would you rate their performance if they were as individual as you would like them to be?
Well, in terms of demonstrating success according to their missions, I mean, there are some states where there's been more success. And what we've seen is that the states that are smaller in terms of the number of charter schools, the states where there's been slower growth, those are states where we see more success and we see more highly accountable charter schools. In part, this is because the authorizers who grant the charters and who oversee the charter schools, they have more time to learn on the go, learn as they work, because they're growing more slowly. And I think Illinois would be classified as one of those states. It was a slow growth state, so they got to learn from the early lessons, and they got to keep the bar high in terms of new applicants. Other states like Michigan and Ohio, they raced to get as many schools up very quickly, and it was very difficult to raise the bar later when they realized that many applicant groups were approved that perhaps shouldn't have been approved. So we see in those smaller states with the slower growth, better accountability and oversight. And also we see there's more likely to see that traditional or that original idea of charter school about accountability, which is mission-driven. So in states like Connecticut or Delaware to some extent, and in Illinois, I think we'd be more likely to see charter schools ready to report on their unique missions, which are, you know, operationalized by measurable goals and objectives related to that mission statement.
My last question would be, what do you see as the future of charter schools?
Well, charter schools are not going to disappear. That's for certain. They're an important part of the landscape right now, and they have a political constituency that will fight for them if and when policymakers wish to curtail them or to shut them down. Unfortunately, I don't see them going back to their original idea of the charter schools, which were going to be unique and open to all kids and so forth. But my sense is, with the growth in the last several years, increasingly we're seeing this as a vehicle for privatization. As I mentioned earlier today, a third of the nation's charter schools are operated by for-profit or non-profit education management organizations. And I think that's probably going to be the future, that will continue to be a vehicle for these private groups to come in and to gain a larger and larger portion of the public school sector.
Thanks so much, Gary, for the insights you've given us.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I enjoyed it.
This is Examining Education. We've been talking to Gary Miron, professor of education at Western Michigan University. Our next program will be on teacher tenure, ways to reform it. For more information about this series, go to our website at examiningeducation.org. Our website also provides links to other sites that include additional details about the issues raised by each guest. Give us your suggestions for future topics and your comments about what you heard today by going to our website or follow us on Facebook, Examining Education. I'm the host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program was presented with audio help from Mike Pritchard and Jason Croft.